Studio 360 is supported by Live from Lincoln Center. On September 13th, Live from Lincoln Center broadcasts the New York Philharmonic Opening Night Gala Concert, featuring music director Lauren Mazel and guest soloists Emmanuel Ax and Yefim Bronfman. Check local PBS listings.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Suppose for a moment that Studio 360 grants a fantasy island-like wish and I can pick an historical figure's life to relive. After encountering an incredible new biography called The Librettist of Venice, an excellent choice would be the life of Lorenzo da Ponte. Da Ponte was born into a Jewish family in Italy in 1749, but over the course of his life, he became a Catholic priest, Mozart's librettist, a bookseller, a professor of Italian, and then a grocer in the United States. Rodney Bolt is the author of The Librettist of Venice, The Remarkable Life of Lorenzo da Ponte, and he joins me today from Barcelona. Welcome to Studio 360.
Hi, thank you.
How did it happen that certainly I never knew about him until now?
I think it's true of most librettists. It's really strange that in the world of the musical, we know about the lyricists. We have Rodgers and Hammerstein, Lloyd Webber, Lerner and Lowe. But in the world of the opera, for some reason, the librettist is wiped out of the scene. And we focus only on the composer, which is very odd.
Well, and I suppose when the composer happens to be Mozart, that tends to overshadow the librettist naturally.
Well, the oddest thing about it was that at the time, da Ponte was more powerful in Vienna than Mozart was. He was a theatre poet. It was Mozart who really wanted da Ponte to write operas for him rather than the other way around.
He did many things, was a man of many parts and had many lives, but clearly being Mozart's librettist was presumably his greatest achievement. He wrote Marriage of Figaro and Così fan tutti and Don Giovanni. What made him so good at that, at being a librettist?
He had an extraordinary feeling for words, and that's clear even in the first opera that he wrote, which incidentally was a disaster. He was a charmer, and he managed to get this position of theatre poet without having written an opera. The first one he wrote was for Salieri, and it was so bad that Salieri said he would cut his fingers off rather than write another opera with da Ponte. And yet, even in that, there is a beautiful sensitivity to the sounds of words and how they can work dramatically.
Do you have, among the operas he wrote for Mozart, a favorite?
Depends on the day. usually it's Figaro. I think that the excitement of their first working together that shows in Figaro and mm-hmm. the relevance it has to their backgrounds, because it was quite a revolutionary opera in that it showed servants being incredibly intimate, if not cheeky, to their masters. And again, we forget that this would have been, at the time, performed in contemporary dress. We now think of it as a period piece.
Right.
But of course, at the time, the people on stage were wearing the same clothes in the same sort of domestic situations as the people in the audience were who were watching them.
How modern of them.
Yes, absolutely. And then to find a servant, as Susanna is in Figaro, being incredibly friendly on a level of equality with the Countess, which is something that da Ponte wrote and that Mozart layers and layers with the most deliciously intimate, affectionate music, was astonishingly revolutionary.
Well, before we go any further, let's have a listen. Do you have a sense that without da Ponte's librettos that we today would consider those great Mozart operas in a lesser light? Did he really help push them over the top into the pantheon?
He possibly wouldn't have written them. Both Mozart and da Ponte worked with other composers and librettists, and arguably neither of them produced anything like they did when they worked together.
Mm-hmm.
And the Italian operas that Mozart was working on before he met De Ponte, which he abandoned, one called The Goose of Cairo, which has a mechanical goose in it, really dreadful, perhaps give an indication of what he would have been forced to do had he not met a librettist who could really deliver what he needed. If we look at Don Giovanni, I think we can see what De Ponte does. It was based on another opera about Don Giovanni, which happened often at the time. And if we look at the famous catalogue song where the servant of Don Giovanni lists the conquests of his master, we can see exactly what De Ponte does. The original, which was by a man called Bertati, just gives over 100 people that his master's used, cento e tante. And beyond that, he doesn't know how many, ve ne sono non so quante. At tanta, quanta, the sort of dull rhymes that Mozart objected to. What De Ponte does is he takes the same song, almost word for word, but he changes the numbers, and he makes them specific and much more witty. In Italy, there are 640, say 140. In Germany, 231, 231. And in Spain, 1,003, 1,003. And if you listen to the catalogue song, Mozart jumps on that bouncy rhythm of mille tre, and it repeats it all the way through.
So De Ponte was something of a ladies' man himself, maybe not at the level of Don Giovanni, but he was actually friends with Casanova. And at the same time, De Ponte was a Catholic priest. How did all of that go together?
The family converted from Judaism in order probably to better themselves economically, certainly to make life a bit easier. And one of the offshoots of this was that Lorenzo, as he was born Emmanuel Conegliano, he had to change his name to Lorenzo De Ponte when he was baptized. And one of the offshoots of the conversion was that he became educated in a seminary. He worked at the seminary as a teacher, as a professor, but then suddenly just up sticks for Venice, where it appears he'd been having an affair with a woman for a long time, a noblewoman in Venice. And Venice at the time was an extraordinarily decadent place. The carnival went on for 6 months of the year. People flocked from all over Europe to what was really the pleasure center of the world.
So that our Casanovian caricature of Venice is absolutely correct.
Absolutely, yes. And it was in Venice that he met Casanova, and he wasn't the only priest who was carrying on like that. In fact, while he was there, there was an incident where two nuns had fought a duel with knives over a visiting official from the Vatican with whom they'd both fallen in love. And the only reason that they were censured was that they did so outside the walls of the abbey where everybody could hear about it rather than inside in privacy. So the church, especially in Venice at the time, was not as pure as can be.
And then how did he go from being a Catholic priest to marrying a woman named Nancy in what apparently was a Jewish wedding ceremony?
It's all very cloudy. And he met her when he was 42 and she was 22. He'd already been thrown out of Venice. He had no money, no prospects, no teeth, because a jealous rival in love some years earlier had given him nitric acid to drink, pretending it was a cure for toothache, which it certainly was. And yet he managed to charm Nancy and marry her in some sort of ceremony that was specific enough to be given a date and a time and for her parents to approve of. And as you say, a friend of Casanova's wrote to Casanova saying that he had witnessed them getting married in a synagogue. And Nancy was also from a converted family. So it's quite possible that they did have a Jewish ceremony. But he himself is very secretive about this and doesn't let on at all. He had to write to Casanova, begging Casanova, please, to stop addressing letters to him as Abbé de Ponte, that he was now plain Mr.
One of the amazing things to me when I first heard about your book and this biography is that it could possibly be that Mozart's collaborator existed in America. I don't think of America and Mozart sort of occupying the same universe.
Well, it is almost as if de Ponte had two lives, that he had this whole 18th century life with friend of Casanova, powdered wigs, writing for Mozart, and then came to America as one of the very first Italian immigrants, because really the Italian movement to America was in the 1830s, 1820s. He was there in 1805. There were only a couple of hundred Italians in New York. He arrived penniless and went on to make good, to become professor of Italian at Columbia, to be part of the founding of the first opera house in New York. And it really is a sort of classic 19th, almost 20th century American dream story.
Well, and I guess somebody who was so prone to such profound reinvention had to end up in America.
It was absolutely the place for him. And it does seem that Nancy made a better go of it than he did, because he was a hopeless businessman and it kept going bankrupt and failing. And she seems to have kept on course. She made a huge amount of money in the coffee salon that she ran in London, so much so that when he arrived, she had come to America a few months before him. She handed him $7,000, which was a huge amount of money in 1805.
Huge.
Thomas Jefferson's secretary earned $500 salary that year. And for $11,000, you could commission and completely equip an ocean-going ship. Yeah, and she had $7,000, which she had most likely made in her coffee shop in London. He lost it all within a year, of course, in his first disastrous grocery shop.
Now, are there today thousands of de Ponte descendants living in the United States, do we suppose?
We don't know. His children died very young. There's one, his youngest child, who was born in America, called Charles or Carlo, who seems to have had an argument with his father and disappeared. One of the theories is that he went out west, but there is no trace of that line of the family. So there are very possibly some descendants of Mozart's librettist living in California who don't really know of their history.
And if any of them are out there, they can get in touch, I guess. Rodney Bolt, thank you very much for joining me today.
Thank you.
Rodney Bolt is the author of The Librettist of Venice, The Remarkable Life of Lorenzo de Ponte. You can find out more about it and him at studio360.org. Now, if I'd introduced some piece of Mozart incorrectly with the wrong Kirkel listing number, I'm sure I would hear from a dozen Mozart lovers correcting me. Well, it turns out it's not just classical music fans who are that persnickety. The week before last, I called a certain album, "The Name of This Band is the Talking Heads." But that's wrong. The name of the album is "The Name of This Band is Talking Heads."
Can't seem to face up to the...
I want to thank those Talking Heads fans for correcting me, and I want to thank all of you for listening to Studio 360 today. I hope you'll join us again for next week's show. Studio 360 is produced by WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Julie Burstein,
David Krasnow,
Lital Malad,
Michelle Siegel,
Ave Carrillo,
Derek John,
Sarah Lilly,
Eric Malinsky,
Monica Carrier,
Adam Walton,
Lori Ann Agnesi.
And our theme music is by David Van Tegum.
Studio 360 is funded in part by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, and the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes a great nation deserves great art.
PRI, Public Radio International.